Welcome to the Diary 101 podcast. I am your host, Aka Kanjalu Kandapwe, also known as Aka. What a long name. And I have two other names I don't share. Interesting. So today is one of those episodes you've been looking forward to, but very nervous to actually have, because then you're like, I really am looking forward to having a conversation with somebody I look up to. And then I got them here. So she is an amazing woman, obviously. Yes, she is an amazing woman doing great stuff for human beings, especially women. The background is I have struggled with the perceptions of women, and because I'm a recent graduate and I am now in the working system, I have a lot of questions that have not been answered, and also feel like we're never told what would happen. It's like when you graduate school, no one ever tells you what comes afterwards, because everybody thinks you'll figure it out. Or when you have a child, or it's like a lot of stuff us women, we don't talk about. So with that being said, I really can't wait to have this conversation, and today's guest is Linda Kasonde. Hi.
Hello, Aka Kandelwa. Nice to talk to you today, and hello to all the listeners out there.
Nice to have you. It's always a pleasure talking to you and catching up. I've talked to you a few times, but it's rare. I have to say, it's every time I reach out to somebody older I really look up to, I always have these expectations. And surprisingly, you actually met them, which is good for me. Which is good for me. But I'm saying that in the sense that leading to these conversations, I asked everybody closest in my circle to say, if you had a question for Linda Kasonde, what would that be? And I have a list.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Everybody was like, oh my goodness, we can't wait for Women's Month, because then she is going to be the highlight of the podcast, which makes me excited. So leading to that, my question to you, the first one is, what's the one thing that was normalized when you joining Laz that you just thought, this can't work for me?
Could you explain that question?
The context would be, you at first, before you were last president, you had a different position, right? When you joined, there are certain things in the workplace where they always say, this is how we do it and it's normal. And for you, it doesn't feel normal, but because everybody in the environment says this is how it's been done and it's normal, why do you want to change it? What's that one thing or a few stuff that always didn't sit right with you?
Well, I suppose when you deal with any institution or organization, there's a way that things have been done in the past. And in my instance, when I became last president, obviously I was the first woman to be elected to that position. And initially I found that some of the men on the council had a bit of difficulty accepting my point of view. Because obviously, as the leader of the bar association, of Laz, I had to guide debates, express opinions, and sometimes it appeared to be difficult for some of our male folk to accept that a woman was expressing an opinion. And so I decided to employ a tactic to help move things along. So before every meeting, I would prepare. I would ensure I had allies going into a meeting, so that when I did express an opinion, it was supported both by men and women. So that was something that I found was a kind of way of things that had been done before, which had to change when I arrived.
Wow. Going back to you being last president, being elected as last president, what are some of the things, like what led you to actually say, I want to stand for presidency? What are the discussions behind the scene with your community when you were making that decision?
It was actually a decision I made a few years prior to becoming last president. I would say a good 5 to 7 years before, because it was an aspiration of mine, because I enjoyed the work that the Law Association of Zambia did very much. And I always used to say to myself, it's something I would do for free, if only I didn't have to pay bills. And ultimately, when I did become last president, I did have to take a sabbatical from work. And I was the first last president to perform the role full time.
No, it makes a lot of sense. I'll give an example of myself, right? Every time I make a big decision, or just even a little decision, I always feel like I need some sort of validation. So I always go to the closest people around me. Some decisions are just made, stone set. Others, I go to the people around me, my friends especially, my mentors, and I'm like, what do you think about this decision? Should I look at it in a different way? So it actually takes me longer to make decisions or act on decisions, because I am always going back and forth with somebody older, or just a peer, just to try to pick on the idea, what would go wrong, what wouldn't go wrong. And I think, I don't know, but maybe other women my age go through the same thing, where you're never confident about the decision you make, that you always have to ask somebody for advice and just keep asking and asking till, I don't know, you reach a certain point, you're like, okay, I think this is a good enough decision for me to move forward. Have you been asked those questions before by other women?
Let me just add to what I said earlier. In the when I decided to put myself forward as last president, as I mentioned, it was a few years before I became last president. I had put it on my vision board as something that I was aspiring towards, and I worked my way up the ladder. Deliberately and consistently. And I made sure that in whatever position that I was elected to, I performed very well, and I had results to show for my presence. But obviously, when it came down to actually filing my nomination, I did have to consult with other people, because obviously, it's one thing to want the position, it's another thing to actually get elected to it. And so I did consult people around me. And in fact, some people had even discouraged me on the basis that they didn't think I was well known enough at the time. And I then consulted another friend of mine who gave me a book called Dare to Fail. And basically, the moral of the story in that book is that if you want something enough, then you won't be swayed by people's opinions or views on your decision. The first hurdle is to put yourself forward. And obviously, you need to be prepared for whichever way it goes, whether you win or you lose. But I gave it my all. Thankfully, everything turned out okay.
I, as the second time in another interview, you talked about Dare to Fail. I think I'll read the book pretty soon.
Well, one thing I'll say about it, it's not exactly a work of literary genius, but I found the story itself very powerful.
That's interesting. So when you got into office, what was it like versus your expectation and the actual reality of being in office? Like there was you probably had an expectation of what you think it is like to be in the office and the actual reality of being the last president.
I mentioned that I had worked my way up the ladder of office. So I had basically occupied every single office it was possible to occupy apart from treasurer. So I was initially member of a committee, heading a committee, then became council member, then became honorary secretary, then became vice president, and then became president. I have to admit that because I had been vice president for 2 years before standing for the position of president, I didn't actually think it would be as huge a leap as it ended up being. Because when you're president, the buck stops with you. And basically, you've got to ensure that nothing collapses under your watch, if you like. And that's quite a heavy responsibility to bear. And it's something I didn't anticipate how heavy that weight would be. Compared to my previous position of vice president. But all in all, I would say the fact that I worked my way right from the bottom to the top prepared me in ways that perhaps some people who just start at the top might not experience. And certainly because it was a very tumultuous time, it was good preparation. And I had all the tools I needed to perform.
That's interesting. One of the things I like about, I was listening to some of your videos and you mentioned Madeleine Albright. And I did a program that grilled us on learning about Madeleine Albright's work. And one thing she likes to mention is you always have to have certain tools in your toolbox for you to be very successful in anything you want to achieve. So yeah, that reminded me of her. What you just mentioned.
In fact, one of my favorite one of two sayings that she used to say, and she's now deceased, is that there's plenty of room in the world for mediocre men, but there's no room for mediocre women. You have to perform because it becomes a reflection on the entire gender. That's how the world sees it. They don't just look at you as an individual. They start painting you with the brush that all women are going to be failures if you're a failure. So it's important, especially as the first person to occupy an office, to really be outstanding.
I like that. What do you think are some of the challenges women face in leadership positions?
There are many. As you know, we live, as they say, it's a man's world. So it is expected that people who lead will be men in many examples. And it's not expected for women to be very, to have strong opinions and to be tough, I guess. So those are the challenges I face in terms of challenging stereotypes about women and their place in society. But sometimes you also live up to certain stereotypes, if you like. So, for example, there are negative stereotypes about women in leadership. If you're tough, then you're too aggressive. If you stand firm, you're difficult. So there are many challenges, and in some ways there are many challenges I didn't have to face. So for example, I don't have a family, so I didn't have the added responsibility of, for example, caring for children or a home. Well, I mean, I have a home, but you know what I mean. So in that sense, I could be laser focused on the task at hand. And perhaps that made it, well, I don't know. I don't know if it made it easier.
It probably
but it was certainly a different experience.
I think it might have been easier, but then also it would have brought questions like, maybe you're not married because you are, I heard your nickname was Iron Lady. Maybe you're not married because you're Iron Lady and no one would want to settle down with somebody like you. Those type of questions, I think, would have maybe been brought up more.
Thankfully, I mean, that may have been the case, but that had nothing to do with how I performed my role in terms of the challenges of performing the role itself.
Yeah.
So that was the context in which I was mentioning having a family.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if I can go this direction, but when you made the decision of not wanting a family, was this all in play or it just naturally happened?
I don't know that I've actually made that decision. It's just how things have panned out. I don't know what the future holds. Yeah. But I do think that people shouldn't be afraid of the demand society places on women in terms of what roles they should play in society. I don't necessarily think you have to fit into the society's box. There are many ways to be a woman, and it doesn't make any choice that you make less valid.
I needed to hear that. What inspired you to pursue a career in law and human rights
activism?
Activism. Oh, thank you. I was too pronouncing it. Thank you.
Well, I enjoyed it. I first studied it in my undergraduate degree, and I found it very interesting. And it also appealed to my nature to defend the underdog. And then I studied it also at master's level. And that was that. I didn't think I'd ever use it after I studied it, quite frankly. I did start my career at a legal aid clinic, but it wasn't strictly a human rights organization. It more dealt with family law and inheritance. It just so happened that our clientele were people who couldn't afford legal services. But the main cases that we took on were around family law and inheritance. So I first used it, in fact, when I set up Chapter One Foundation. Prior to that, I had sort of used it at the Law Association, interacting with other organizations in the region on human rights work and workshops. But I think principally, I really used it at Chapter One.
What's the story behind Chapter One Foundation? How did you set it up? I think I kind of get the why, but how did you decide to say, I let's set up Chapter One Foundation and let's pursue this fully and have something people that are less privileged can fall back on?
I started Chapter One because at the time I left the Law Association, I felt like there was still a lot of work to be done in the human rights and governance space, and I needed a platform to be able to do that. So it was, I think, also out of necessity in terms of there was a gap in civil society with regards to that kind of work. There were no, there were very few legal organizations that provided that service in that way. I think there'd been previously something like it in the late 90s to early 2000 when Lucy Sichone ran her organization. But since then, since it changed into a child rights organization, there was nothing to fill the gap of promoting and protecting human rights and the rule of law through legal expertise. So that was the gap that we filled in Zambia.
What do you think about the gap now? Like, has it reduced, or we still have so much work? Has it maybe turned the coin and it looks differently now? But how's the gap when it comes to the human rights and the governance in Zambia?
So I think in a lot of ways, Chapter One fulfilled its mission. Well, I'm not saying it's completed. I'm just saying it fulfilled the mission in terms of filling that gap to promote human rights and the rule of law and social justice in the country. But of course, the work is enormous. There's so many challenges out there, and Chapter One Foundation is only one organization. And of course, it collaborates with different organizations around its mission and objectives. So it's gone, you know, quite a long way in filling that gap. But one thing that I was quite deliberate about, so when I first started Chapter One Foundation, people thought I was crazy. Like, you're leaving a commercial law firm to set up an NGO. People didn't get it. But thankfully, we proved ourselves very quickly, very early on. And that cemented our reputation as the foremost human rights organization in the country. It was also gratifying to create a different vocation for lawyers outside of commercial law, that people could be human rights lawyers in a way that maybe they hadn't been before. So that was also very gratifying.
One thing I'm learning about you is I feel like you live life with seasons, and everything you've done has been according to a certain season. It's not very linear, I would say. You don't leave it in terms of, I have one career path and I will stick to it till I am 70. It's, you have done different stuff at different times, and I think you keep evolving, and I feel like you're exploring my heart or mindset, where you keep evolving, you keep trying something new, and every time you're told you can't achieve it, you're like, I hope you have a front row seat and I'll show you how I can do it.
Yes, much to the dismay of my mother, who's had the same job for the last 40 years. So my role model in this respect is Oprah Winfrey. I think she's somebody who continues to evolve and remain relevant through different times in the world. And she says herself that she'll continue to grow until she dies, because her philosophy is to fulfill her purpose on earth and to do it to the highest possible standard, to use up whatever talents she has to the best of her ability for as long as possible. And I think I subscribe to that view. Life is ever changing.
And you're ever evolving, which is so inspiring. When I grow up, I'm going to be just like you.
Oh, thank you.
Yes.
You'll be a better version of you.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but I'm glad we have people like you to look up towards.
Thank you. Appreciate
yes. that. So could you please tell me a little bit about LCK Chambers?
Okay, so LCK Chambers was actually opened at the same time as Chapter One Foundation. So initially, the two worked together because NGOs couldn't provide legal services, couldn't perform legal services. So LCK did all the legal work. So all those cases that you know about Chapter One Foundation being in the press, most of those were done by LCK Chambers. So initially it was set up as a social enterprise to support the work of Chapter One Foundation and also meant to sort of supplement income that the Chapter One was raising to meet its needs. So that was the original intent. But when I left Chapter One Foundation, I decided to make it into a commercial firm. So that is the point at which we're at now. And Chapter One has its own chambers, Chapter One Chambers. So, yes, we have evolved.
And how was that experience, and how did you get to a decision to leave Chapter One Foundation and commercialize LC Chambers?
It was a difficult decision to leave Chapter One Foundation because the work aligned with many things that I believe in, many values that I hold. But ultimately, I decided to leave because I was not getting any younger and I needed to do something that would help provide for my retirement at the end of the day. So that is why I left. So LCK Chambers is now a profit-making entity and the work we do, we also still do some cases for people who can't afford legal services, but those are very few because we have very few staff at the moment. But I'm sure with time, we too shall grow and our capacity to provide services will also grow.
When you look back to all these decisions, what's the one thing you were very consistent with when making decisions to do something new or to leave something you were familiarized with or you started to do the next thing?
I normally follow my passion. I have to be interested in what I'm doing. It has to give me joy. It has to be something that I feel like I can do even without being paid, but of course I want to be paid. So those are really the driving factor behind the choices I make.
That does sound like me on most days.
Oh, What would you say are your passions?
My passion is helping people realize their full potential. The school system, the background story is I struggled with formal schooling, and it took me a while to just, for example, learn how to read and write properly. So my grandfather was very keen in my education, like pushing me to like get those grades. But also because I'm the first grandchild, but I grew up in an extended house. What that meant was I was the youngest, but not liked by my older cousins, and so much competition. So everybody wanted attention, and being the youngest, being the one that's not performing well at school, I needed to learn how to place myself. So I said to be proactive in non-curriculum activities like running and volunteering and working with organizations. So now when I look back to ACCA at 15, because I started this at 15, it makes sense that I knew my strength wasn't at being book smart, but I was smart at other stuff. And over the years, that's what has helped me get different opportunities. So, yeah, I think for me, I've been very consistent about just knowing that I wasn't book smart and that wasn't going to help me in any way. So most of the book stuff I did was because my family wanted me to get a degree or something. But then if they want me to do something, I would always negotiate to say, instead of me getting a medicine degree, can I get it in business? Because certain things always come easier to me because I've been interacting with people and I'm interested. So, yes, I think I've been very consistent with negotiating my way through what I wanted because I learned my strengths and weaknesses very young and early.
Well, I mean, I think this is also a symptom of our education system in the sense that not everybody learns the same. I mean, talking to you, I can see you are an intelligent person, but perhaps, you know, there's some people who have learning difficulties, not because they're not intelligent, but because of the way their mind works. It's for example, there's dyslexia and things like that. So it's not anything to do with the person's intelligence. It's just how they process reading, for example. So yeah, these are sometimes just challenges of our education system, which doesn't recognize those things and have facilities in place to support people who need more support. So I don't think it's from a lack of book smarts. It's just you process things differently.
And I'm very hyper. I was a very hyper child. And when I did my evaluation later, like I think in 2023, then we discovered that I have ADHD, right? I'm very hyper and I can get very low on energy. And I needed a different way to learn. I think I was being taught better at home than I was at school. So my grandfather did a better job with grounding me at home. And like the one-to-one reading and everything I did at home helped my school life. But yeah, I think if, like you mentioned, if the education system could just recognize that different kids have different way of learning, I think I would have probably been helped a lot. And I wouldn't have felt anxious or depressed while in school, because if you're not the smartest one in the house, it comes at a cost. And you really have to learn to navigate not being the book smart one in the house, or smart in the way they want you to be smart and at the pace they want you to be smart. But I'm so grateful for that experience. I wouldn't be here if I didn't just take it for what it was and moved on and just found an alternative of bringing them so much grace and glory and making them proud. So, yeah. That's like, well, That's a story for another day. talking about childhoods and memories, if you'd go back to a 10-year-old Linda and give her advice, what advice would you give her?
Well, I mean, I've been asked this question many times, and
you have?
Oh my goodness. Yes, I have. Well, it gets asked sort of more like, what would you tell your younger self? So not specifically my 10-year-old self, but 10-year-old Linda was actually quite assertive. It changed during teenagehood, but I would say to my 10-year-old self, you know, everything works out the way it should, so don't stress too much.
Ooh. A 10-year-old you was already thinking about how things would work out? That's interesting.
No. All I mean is, I think what I had said is that I was quite assertive as a 10-year-old. Yeah. Not that I knew what was going to unfold in the future, no. But I definitely made my opinions known and expressed them.
My grandfather would say I was cheeky for expressing my opinions. He's like, you're very cheeky. I feel bad for the person that's going to marry you.
Oh.
Yeah, on any given day. But I'm so grateful. I think I was also very assertive. Still am. But now I pick my words very carefully to make everybody around me feel better about themselves. And I think that's something when we had our pre-meeting and we talked about your book, I was like, one of my struggles now is I don't think the older generation were having conversations about what really happens in a workspace. And you mentioned something to do with the cost of being one that would actually speak up and just say it as it is, not as it how we think it should be. So when you were writing your book, what was the thought process behind it?
Well, I'll answer by explaining why I wrote the book. So I wrote the book for two reasons. Firstly, for myself, to be able to just process my experiences, because it was a lot. So I needed to unpack everything and, if you like, release it. And the second reason was that I didn't know of very many autobiographies, so memoirs by African women in the more political side of things. And I especially thought of women during the independence struggle. We don't know many of their stories, because they didn't write about them, because nobody's telling their stories. So I thought it was important on that level as well to make it, to normalize telling things as they were for future, for people to be able to learn from experiences, because it's very difficult to learn from somebody who presents a very perfect veneer. You know, everybody thinks, oh, that person looks good, they speak well, they dress well, they must have a perfect life. And it's very difficult to understand or to learn from what those person's experiences are if they're not truthful about them. But I also know that it's not easy to tell the truth about your experiences, because people will judge you often negatively for saying things that are, if you like, less favorable about yourself or not pretty. So there's definitely that. And we are quite a conformist society, if you like. So when you do things outside of the norms, that also gets judged. So I perfectly understand reasons why people don't do it, but it was important to me to set an example for anyone behind me who may want to do it, to share their experiences for the benefit of other people as well.
And honestly, I'm so grateful that you are sharing your experiences and you're very honest about it, or truthful. I can't wait to read the book, because then I've been trying to learn more about the women older than me that are very successful, and trying to understand some of the things I might need to anticipate, because if you want a level of success, it does come at a cost. And like you said, if we don't have enough people coming up front and just saying it as it is, which is understandable why they don't want to say it, because there's another cost to that, it doesn't really prepare the people, the younger generations like me, who is making all these big plans, but I am reading the cost to success at a man's perspective, not a woman's perspective, because what a man might go through, I'll probably go through it differently and actually more, because I'm just a woman. So yeah, it's really something I am grateful for, honestly, and I've been looking forward to just, yeah, have somebody I can read the book about and go like, I relate so much. And one of my favorite books is Lean In. There's so much I am like, oh, I should really anticipate this if I really want to be that successful. So yeah, thank you so much. What advice would you give a young person that a young woman that wants to be successful?
Don't be afraid to fail. Because if you're not prepared to take any risks, you might not learn from your experiences to set you up for success down the line.
Wow.
And maybe just to give a bit of context, again, in our society, women are afraid to fail. There's a pressure to appear perfect, to be good, to be to present yourself as a particular kind of woman. And again, because our society is very conformist, if you are different in any way, again, you get judged. But I think if you want to pursue something that is outstanding, that is excellent, that is above average, then there's an element of risk to that. I don't advocate for carelessness. I always advocate for calculated risks. But also, I think I would say, be comfortable with yourself and accept who you are, because it's only when you are your authentic self that you'll truly live to your maximum potential.
So we're coming at the end of the podcast, and I want to give you an opportunity to ask me a question.
Actually, I prepared for this as we were chatting earlier, because you said two things to me. You said we were talking about your name being long.
Yeah.
You said, yeah, my name is long, but people just call me Maaka, and I don't even talk about my other two names. So my two questions to you are, what does Akakandelwa mean, and what are your other two names?
Akakandelwa means somebody that is very particular. I was named by my grandmother. She named me by her mother, so my great-grandmother. So names have meaning, and they said I'm the polar opposite of my great-grandmother, but it always means somebody that's very particular in how things are done. So it's actually ingrained in my personality. I would say I'm very particular. I like things done in a specific way, and I always like to ask why, right? Why can't I do this this way? No, it's, you can't do that because you're a woman. And growing up, we were told we had to do household chores and we had to learn how to cook. And they would always refer to the point where, because we're going to marry you off, we want you to be able to do this for your husband. So one day, because I go to my grandfather and I say, so the women in the kitchen are saying, I have to learn all these skills because you're going to be, I'll be married off. Not because I am a human being and I shouldn't have them as life skills. I don't want to learn them, so I'm not going to do it. So my grandfather calls everybody and says, well, I don't know what you said to her, but she has decided that she's going to take a break from learning household chores for 2 years. So growing up, I was a very particular child, still am as an adult. If it doesn't add up in my head, it doesn't add up. I respect everybody's opinion. I get where you're coming from. But you need to convince me for more than just being a girl. So, because a lot of stuff is taught. If you're Zambian or an African and you come from a traditional household, you are taught to do stuff because you're a woman, not because you're a human being. And I had the male cousins or the male uncles that would not do anything. So we reached a consensus, I think, a few months later, where I got the other guys to start doing chores too. So it started feel like, yes, it started to feel like we can all cook in this house. But I still remain the worst cook in the house because it's not my talent. So, yeah, it's like that's just like one example of one of the moments I just said, as a child in this house, this doesn't add up and I just don't feel like doing it. And now everybody jokes about how I've been very particular about a few stuff, about my success, about me one day traveling abroad, about who I want to become in the future. And now my family reminds me of all those moments as a child. I would say, I would travel to America and you all will see me on TV. And now they're like, okay, she actually did it. Maybe we should start believing her. Yes, so with my name, I also decided to take the positive out of it because when everybody translated it for me, it sounded so negative. And I grew up and I took the positive. I'm like, yes, I should be particular about certain things. I should be particular about my goals. I should be particular about this and that and that. Because others were like, oh, when you're particular, they'd always look at my, some of the things I'm not good at, I would say my weaknesses, right? Like, oh, this is why you're not doing this because your name says this. And I'm like, no, why aren't you associating it to my strength of me saying no half of the time to all of you? So yeah, I think that was a fun memory. I can't believe I did that, but it's so fun. And I look back and I'm like, oh, I'm glad I'm that girl. And I was raised to be that girl. The question, the second one is, what are my two other names? So my two other names were given to me by my dad. So my name is Akakandola, my grandmother. And my dad named me Sophia. I don't know why. But he also named me after his mom. So he named me Likumbi because I'm Luchazi. Then, yeah, my surname is Kandepwe. So initially my names are supposed to be Akakandola, Sophia, Likumbi, Kandepwe. Yeah.
Well, that's lovely. And what does Likumbi mean?
You know what? It's a good question. Because when I asked my dad, he said it meant a queen. Then he told my younger sister that it meant a female mascot. It's like I have many feelings about how he's not being honest. I know. So, yeah, I don't use it that much. I never Googled what it meant. But when I heard it meant a mascot, I was like, I can't be associated to this name. But yeah, I have to ask my dad or ask my grandfather, my dad's side of the family. Maybe he knows. Yeah. But it's interesting to me. It's such an interesting thing to be raised in a very extended family. Yeah.
Well, I enjoyed that. That was great.
I'm so glad. What do you look forward to?
I think we talked about evolving. I think I'm still self-actualizing.
Yeah.
And growing in many ways. And so I look forward to how the next decade will unfold. I'll be turning 50 not long from now. So,
yay!
Yeah, exactly.
There's a party. Please go on.
Yeah, so we'll see what the future holds. I also don't know what's going to happen in the future, but I'm sure God will guide me and that my purpose will give me direction.
I love that. And I just have to say, you achieved so much before 50. It's such an inspiration for me as a young person. I'm like, wait, before 50? You did all that? But it's good to see. It's been great having this conversation with you. It's been an honor. I hope you also listen to it after 50, just to kind of see if you still have like a different point of view on a few stuff.
But yeah, it's been 5 minutes
of having you, and I think as it should be one of those national treasures we have and talk about in the museum. I'm just saying. I'll give them an idea. If you see your work in the museum, just know I brought it up. And I was like, guys, actually, before you go, somebody mentioned something to me. And they say that we might have the parts where we're talking about the first general, man general. Like, we talk about the men's history more. But we also don't talk about the women's history. Like, we don't talk about if there was a first commander-in-chief who was a woman, or just these high positions that were attained by women. Like you said and mentioned earlier, like, we don't talk about it enough. And that gives me an idea for something.
Oh, I can't wait to see what it is.
Yeah, I also can't. I think a lot of young girls... it should be in a textbook, because if we can have men in a textbook, we should have women in a textbook too, because you have rewritten history. And we don't do that enough for women, and we do that enough for men. And I want my sister to know you before she's 20. She doesn't have to study law. She has to, like, when she's studying history in class, there should, like, be a part where they're mentioning all the women that did certain things and achieved and changed, broke barriers at a certain age.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
I already have an idea. Yes, I will reach out to somebody and ask if we could do something like that. That would be fun.
I look forward to seeing what your idea is.
Me too. It's been a pleasure. I hope you enjoyed this. I'm particularly glad we're doing this before your birthday. Because it means I get to listen to this again and again. And afterwards, you get to listen to it again and we see the different perspectives and where life is going to take you. But thank you so much for everything you do for us.
Thank you, Akakandelwa. It was an absolute pleasure to talk to you. And as you promised, I did enjoy it.
I'm so glad. And for everybody listening, I hope you share it with another woman and a man, obviously. But I hope you learn something new. And please follow Linda Kasonde's work and reach out if you have any questions. I would be happy to help and answer them. With that being said, bye for now.